Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 199, recorded for February 8th, 2023. All AI products agree, earnings are down. Good evening, Ryan, Jonathan, Peter. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. How you doing, Justin?
Yeah, you know, it's another fantastic week. Lots going on, and the AIs are taking over. The AI wars have begun. So it's been an exciting week of news, for sure.
All AI.
All AI, all the time. In the arms race. Just who's going to take over.
Yeah.
Well, let's do earnings part two. We talked about earnings for Microsoft a few weeks ago, and so now we're back to talk about Alphabet and Amazon, who released their earnings on the same day, and I will now play the air horn, so plug your ears. See, I warned you this time. I found the sound effect. We lost it last time. I don't know what happened. Our editing software ate it momentarily, but it's back, so we're good. anyways, let's start with Alphabet. Alphabet fourth quarter revenue was $76.05 billion, up from $75.3 billion the year prior. Earnings were $13.62 billion, or $1.05 per share, compared with $20.64 billion from last year. So earnings profitability is down. Alpha's revenue minus traffic extra cost was 63.12 versus 61.9 on the year. There's a quote here from Chief Executive Sundar Pichai. We're on an important journey to re-engineer our cost structure in a durable way and to build a financially sustainable, vibrant, growing business across Alphabet, which explains why they then laid off 12,000 people. So that, you know, makes sense.
And they're not done yet.
Not done
they're
yet.
On an important journey.
On a journey of layoffs, that's what it is. Google did say they have seen a pullback in spending by advertisers amid the challenging economic headwinds, as well as foreign exchange headwinds as well. For what we care about, Google Cloud, they brought in $7.32 billion in revenue, up from $5.54 billion last year, which is a 32% increase, but Q3 had a 38% increase, so not growing quite as fast as it did in Q2. So headwinds all across the Google spectrum. We'll talk a little bit.
It's actually pretty good, though. I'm surprised. It grew by that much.
Well, I mean, again, when your revenue is only $7.32 billion, it's easy to grow at the cloud spend that we're talking about versus Amazon, who's got a much, much larger number to grow.
Yep.
Speaking of Amazon, let's talk about them. They had the least profitable holiday quarter since 2014 and, in fact, reported the worst loss in company history. Not a great start to the Andy Jassy CEO tenure. Profit was $278 million or 3 cents a share, which you go, hey, that's not so bad. But a year ago, profit was $1.39 a share.
Wow.
Overall revenue was $149.2 billion, up from $137.41 billion a year ago. For the fiscal year, Amazon produced a net loss of $2.7 billion, which was the worst in the history of the company, on revenue that was up to $513.98 billion, where last year it was $469.82 billion. Could you imagine losing that kind of money with that kind of revenue? Just blows my mind. They do, some interesting analysis I saw, though, is this all may be short-lived, as Amazon took the bad news bears approach to Q4 earnings and basically took an opportunity to clear its books of all its bad debts and write-offs. So they took out the rest of their Rivian impact for the $2.3 billion in net income, which without they actually would have had a really great quarter. They also took an impairment charge of $2.7 billion, which was split between $640 million in severance and $720 million in closures or impairments of their physical stores. Without those charges, Amazon would have exceeded expectations from Wall Street. But now taking them out now makes 2023 a much cleaner balance sheet, a much better situation. For AWS, which we care about the most here, they produce $5.21 billion in income on revenue of $21.38 billion, which is a 20% growth rate, which was a slight miss of expectations by the analysts who said that they should have made $21.85 billion and profit of $5.73 billion. But apparently they're bad at their jobs and AWS sucked at theirs. I don't know how that works, but that's where we're at.
Wow. less than a half billion difference in 21 billion. I mean, to be fair, that's a pretty good prediction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, penalizing.
A couple hundred million between friends.
Yeah. Penalizing a company for that kind of miss in a in a prediction in this kind of economic climate with all kinds of unpredictability is a little harsh, I would think.
People don't turn their servers off.
It's not, you know, it's interesting, a lot of press this week about how, you know, Amazon.com is actually, you know, it's subsidized completely by Amazon, because without Amazon's or AWS's revenue, they would have been completely in the red and they never would have made a profit. And so, you know, we're continuing to allow Amazon.com to undercut the market of the retailers by subsidizing their business with AWS. So there's a lot of people on Twitter and on Mastodon and all the different services basically talking about, you know, Amazon really needs to get separated away from the rest of the business, which they'll never do.
Why would they?
Amazon.com would never be profitable.
Yeah. It is kind of neat, though. I mean, if they're not profitable, that means they're, if you take away all any fat that's in that business, just means we're getting stuff better, faster, cheaper than we otherwise would if they were making a profit.
Yep. Well, and I think the biggest risk to that, though, is that if AWS growth, you know, continues to slow down its trajectory, eventually costs will surpass their ability to hide that loss. So it's definitely a concern if they can't keep growing top line growth, but we'll see.
It blows my mind how they cannot be profitable without AWS, to be honest, given the volume of sales and the margin they have.
Yeah, you'd think, you're like, okay, guys, all we got to do is spend less than $5 billion this year and we'll be profitable. And again, the government can't do it on whatever, $15 trillion in revenue.
Hey, I mean, if you're now negotiating debt situations in the State of the Union, as they did yesterday, then, you know, you can do a lot of things. So, all right, well, let's move on to stories of the week. AWS, first up, is announcing the horribly named AWS VPC Resource Map, which is a new feature that simplifies the VPC creation experience in the AWS Management Console. The feature shows you your existing VPC resources and their routing visually on a single page, allowing you to quickly understand the architectural layout of your VPC. Apparently, this existed in the new VPC Wizard, which I had not played with for a while. And so when you were doing the VPC Wizard, it would actually show you, you know, your VPC layout. And as you made changes, it would dynamically update. And then when you said, great, create my VPC, it would blow that diagram away and you never get it back. So apparently customers didn't like that. And so now they made this an actual thing you get to keep after your VPC is created. And if you had a VPC created before that existed, you can also now get a pretty graph like the one I included in my show notes, which is the CloudPods VPC network. So there you go. You can see how the bits move in our website. The VPC resource map fixes all those issues and makes it easy to see quickly and efficiently all your visualizations. And I do believe that Foghorn has also created visualizations like this in the past, and many partners have. So, you know, you got Sherlock today. And I'm sorry.
2013, I think.
I mean, that's a good ROI on that investment. 10 years of investment, and you know, in that.
It was so much better than this too. I mean, it was just, there's so much more in it. There's so much more visualization of security groups and ACLs and everything. But it was ugly, but functional. Very.
I mean,
functional.
This isn't that pretty. I mean, it's just lines and boxes.
You think you hate this one?
No, I saw yours. I know what it looks like.
I think I did my first one based off of like the visualization in CloudFormation. So I defined the resource in CloudFormation just so that I could use the UI and take a screenshot of it.
It's not very interesting, to be fair. So you've got a VPC and it has subnets and availability zones. Mm-hmm. Like, okay.
Well, I mean, I will say that the CloudPods network is very simple. So it's not very exciting. But even the one that they have in the screenshots of the official article were not that impressive. So you're sort of right. And this maybe kind of goes back to the comment that Peter made that theirs was better because it had more details and more interesting things. But
resources, yeah, in subnets with a chained security group rule, everything. It was awesome. Yeah. I love that thing.
I mean, I would expect to see a little bit more detail. You know, there's the DNS routing that you can get from Route 53. There's the, you know, the NAT gateways, internet gateways, you know.
VPC endpoints, all that kind of stuff.
You know, there's stuff that, you know, that I think they'll probably add over time to this service. Right now, it doesn't really interest me. But it is nice to be able to visually represent your network, especially if you're, you know, not super familiar with the networking layer.
It's really tough when it's complicated not to visualize it. Like, even if you are familiar with it, it's really tough to understand what the ramifications of the decision are. And then you're like, oh, look at my database servers in the NAT group. Huh.
Yeah. And I'd love to see things like VPC peering represented and yeah. you know, things where it is very complex.
Now, if they could take this and then add it to my organizational overlay and transit gateway and VPC peering,
yeah.
whole end-to-end multi-organization view of my network, I'd pay you money.
Yeah, yeah.
You pay us money, we'll make one that does exactly that and is butt ugly.
But you wouldn't pay as much as Aviatrix.
It's a glowing endorsement. Yes. You'll not pay as much as Aviatrix, that's true. Well, if you were excited about Graviton 3 based instances, but you wanted the bare metal version, you can now get the C7G as a bare metal instance. Of course, the C7G is the newest ARM processor from AWS with 25% better compute performance, 2x higher floating point performance, and up to 2x faster crypto performance, and 3x faster CPU based machine learning performance when compared to AWS Graviton 2. Which includes support for the vFloat 16. With the bare metal, you can now get full access to the 64 vCPU and 120 gigs of memory of the box, and they offer up to 30 gigabits per second of enhanced networking bandwidth and 20 gigabits of bandwidth to the EBS volumes attached to the bare metal instance.
Ooh. what else can you say?
Yeah,
it keeps going.
Yeah.
Keeps getting faster and cheaper.
Yep.
It's a really great Kubernetes box.
Yeah, exactly. I was like trying to think.
Put Kubernetes on that, and then I run my containers, and all's happy in the world. This week, GCP, at their earnings, they basically promised that they were going to have a response to OpenAI. And 2 days later, they basically came out and said, but here's our response. And Google has two choices in naming. They either name things completely obvious, like Google Load Balancer, or they name them in cutesy names like Google Alloy DB. And you're sort of like, what is that? And you're like, well, you have to know it's a Postgres database. Sort of like Aurora. No one really knows what it is unless you know, you read the docs, you listen to our show. And this is sort of in that world too. So they're calling the new AI solution to compete with OpenAI, ChatGPT and all that, Google Bard. Like the poetry from Minstrel of olden days.
Oh.
So this this blog post we linked to today is from Sundar. Where he introduces their new AI product, which they think they said the company pivoted to 6 years ago, but didn't get to market first, with the power to improve billions of lives or destroy them, depending on how you view about AI and future of tech work. They highlight their investments included Google AI and the DeepMind, and they believe the scale of the largest AI computations is doubling every 6 months, far outpacing Moore's Law. They even take credit for many of the technologies that power ChatGPT, saying they're all based on the Transformer researcher paper they wrote in 2017. So, way to try to take credit, Google. Appreciate that. So they are using the Lambda, not that Lambda, the other Lambda, which we made fun of last time we talked about it, which is the Language Model for Dialogue Applications, or LAMDA, and they call it Bard. This is a conversational AI service powered by Lambda, and Google's making it available to trusted testers ahead of making it available to the public in just a few short weeks. Bard seeks to combine the breadth of the world's knowledge with the power, intelligence, and creativity of their large language models, and drawing on the information from the web to provide fresh, high-quality responses. Bard can be used, can be an outlet for creativity, a launchpad for curiosity, or help you explain the James Webb Space Telescope to a 9-year-old, or learn more about the best strikers in football right now, and then get the drills to build your skills up as well. The launch will leverage the lightweight model version of Lambda, which requires less computing power, which means cheaper for Google, enabling them to scale to more users and allowing more feedback. They intend to use external feedback with their own internal testing to ensure Bard's responses meet a high bar for quality, safety, and groundedness in real-world information. And again, they then pivoted to talk about all the previous models they have released that they didn't actually release to the public, including BERT and MUM, which was released 2 years ago. And that was apparently 1,000 times more powerful than BERT. And the newest AI technologies will start with Lambda, but then also be expanded to use Palm, Imogen, and MusicLM in the future. And they will start seeing this in all of their search products and across the ecosystem. And they also mentioned several partners like Cohere, C3 AI, and Anthropic, who will all be involved in their AI service. So they're trying to be aggressive about their response to ChatGPT because the stock market was getting spooked. They were behind the eight ball and it was going to destroy Google. And this is their response.
My favorite comment, and I don't know where I heard it or I'd give them credit, but it was, how was Google the first one to start looking into AI and still be late to the market?
Yeah, really.
But in a way, it serves a purpose. I mean, they were late to the cloud and they've learned from other people's mistakes. They're late to monetizing this, but they'll have OpenAI to learn from and ChatGPT. I don't see them opening up this to the public like OpenAI did. I mean, they got 2 million plus users now in the space of a couple of months. It's costing them millions of dollars a day probably at this point in compute to just promote the service that they're going to monetize soon. I don't think Google will do that. But they obviously have the technology. We've been hearing about it in the news with people thinking that it was sentient for months or even years now.
Well, so, yeah. Person. I don't know about
Sundara Borg. Is that what this is?
Yeah, so this is a great time to transition to Azure news or Microsoft. So, you know, after Google basically announced that they were going to, have the Bard service, Microsoft quickly scheduled a press conference to announce the resurgence of Bing. For those of you like Ryan who used to fight Bing and Yahoo when he's worked there, this is a bad omen of what's come to come, as they've now powered Bing with the power of ChatGPT and the Edge browser, which everyone uses the Edge browser, and combine those into one unified ChatGPT monster, which is now going to be available to you in the public very, very soon. Microsoft goes on to say there's 10 billion search queries a day, but they estimate over half do not get answered properly. And the features of the new Bing and Edge will give you better search, complete answers, a new chat experience, a creative spark for new ideas, and the new Microsoft Edge experience. And they talk about this combining all of their amazing breakthroughs of OpenAI, ChatGPT, and much, much more. This is all going to be delivered to you in a new user experience the next few days. You can go sign up right now to start getting access to the new Bing if you want to get Binged. And I'll tell you that I went and used Bing today because it's been about a long time since I used it last, and it's still garbage. So I can't wait to see the new experience, and hopefully it's less garbage. We'll see. But, it could be their chance to finally get some Bing market share. Because, you know, for every 10%, wasn't it $1 billion in revenue they thought it would bring them? So if I remember back to the old days of why they wanted to buy Yahoo.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, I think this is a genius play just because I think that, you know, it's, if you think about like, you know, how people have, how started using search, and what has changed over time. Like I remember that, you know, in the early days, you weren't even really asking it in normal language. You were typing in keywords and restructuring them manually to sort of change your results to get more accurate results. And now it's with, you know, natural language processing that you can actually make your search results worse if you don't ask it in a, you know, common language. Putting an AI in front of that to sort of, you know, bridge the gap, I think will lead to, you know, hopefully much better search results and much better experience on Bing, which largely has been just nightmarish compared to Google. Although, you know, maybe, I don't know, like you, I don't think I've done a Bing search in like a decade just because it was so terrible for so long that I just gave up.
Yeah. Well, I tried to go use the new chat thing and I went there and I did search and I was like, okay, that's nice. And then I'm like chat. And it's like, oh, if you want to use the chat thing, you can get, you know, you can get added to the Bing early access faster by using Microsoft products. And I was like, well, that's not antitrust at all. So right. It just like 10 years ago all over, which is kind of amazing.
I was reading an article on like the, you know, the difference between using, you know, an AI search engine versus, you know, just a normal search engine. You know, like it's the way you ask questions would be completely different, right? So if you, you know, the example that I was hearing was, you know, someone asking if this specific couch would fit in the back of their car, right? It's not something you can easily search in a common search, right? You have to get the dimensions, go to a couple different sites, correlate the data yourself, and then sort of make a judgment call versus, you know, AI powered would do all that work for you. So I do think it could be a game changer if done well.
Yeah, but going to the two or three sites, clicking on the two or three sites that you need links and expertly passing by the advertising links while doing so is how they're making their money, right? Missing and clicking on advertising links and doing a search and finding other stuff. If it just gives you the answer, I think that might be harder to monetize.
But it actually might be more valuable to monetize because now I will this couch fit in the back of my Toyota Prius, for example? And it calculates and it's like, well, no, but here's a ADT Movers who can move that item for you for, you know, $70. You can now give a direct, you know, I know this is a need you have because you just did a search for it, and I can sell that to an advertiser who now has a qualified lead versus just a potential lead. That's tremendously valuable to them as well.
That's probably a fairly narrow use case.
I'm just going to start getting, can I do better on my mortgage? The minute you get it, just get everybody, all these call centers lighting up on every search I do.
Yeah.
The problem is they suck with references though. I mean, ChatGPT certainly does. In fact, if you ask it to write something and give you references, it will literally make up references that look like real references. I mean, I'm hoping they can fix that for search and that the answers can be tied back to actual pages. So you can say, well, what's a good place to go and read about this? Or I've got some questions about this topic. Can you suggest some sites that would answer my questions or, you know, give me details? I think making that connection back from the generative text back to a site that actually can, you know, you can cite is going to be the hard part in this. It's going to be a novelty for a long time, I think, before it really sees really strong adoption because it's become useful, truly.
Really? I mean, I would think that would be the easiest part of the problem just because that's the part that's more common to the search engines now, right? The indexing all of the internet and deriving a score for keywords is effectively, you know, they'll still have that data. They'll still have all the crawlers running out there and the AI can utilize that for
that's not how the model was trained originally. I mean, imagine searching, where can I find some, you know, 3-centimeter long M6 bolts.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
okay.
I need 60 millimeter M5s right now, and I have to buy 50 if I want one. It's exactly. Ridiculous.
I mean, I got the same problem. I mean, there's Ace Hardware, there's Home Depot, there's all kinds of different places. So how do you monetize then the result that the search engine gives you so that it prioritizes saying, well, you know, this particular store has it, but this, you know, this one also has it, but they pay me less.
It's the same thing. It's sponsored results. Right, like it's exactly the same mechanism that they use today.
Yeah, but if they're already making a low margin, like can they really afford to buy the search result to get that business? Yeah,
that's the bet, right? Like the bet is twofold, right? Improve the experience so people will actually start using Bing, number one. and then number two, you know, like build that so that you can charge more for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's called Google Keywords for a reason. You pay for keywords. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm still trying to wrap my head around this like whole concept of going and searching based on like, will this thing fit in my car? Like that's not how I've been trained to search the web for a long time. I think I might actually I'm too old for this crap because like I don't know that my brain can actually remap the neurons necessary to make this type of search work. My kids will probably be brilliant at it because they're used to asking Alexa those type of questions. I'm screwed, I think.
Yeah, this is our blinking VCR. It's 12 midnight for the rest of eternity. Yeah. I'll be yelling at a computer because I want to just type it random words and give me results. It's not going to know what I'm talking about.
I don't want to ask you. I don't want to ask you in the form of a question. Yeah. This is not Jeopardy.
I have enough friends.
I don't know. Maybe it's time to retire. Maybe this is the moment. I'm starting to rethink my 5-year plan. Like, wait a minute. Maybe it's... it's gonna keep me up tonight. Thanks, appreciate that. Hey, well, let's talk about things I understand. New regions. I understand regions. Azure has announced that they are going to establish a new region in Saudi Arabia with several availability zones. This is the second major cloud provider to enter Saudi Arabia after Google Cloud announced it a couple years ago. At this point, so you know, the sovereignty requirements in Saudi Arabia are quite stringent, and so this makes sense that one cloud provider would be there. I don't know if it makes sense for two, but yeah, we'll see how it goes. But nice to have choices so you don't just have GCP in the region. And now the question is, does AWS follow suit or do they stay out of it and just let these two beat each other up?
I mean, if you're already invested in cloud and have, you know, your infrastructure in one cloud, you're going to ask your cloud provider for, you know, any need that you have. And so like, I can see why there could be all three for that. But I, you know, I do think it won't, because it, you know, will be smaller and it'll be at a premium. They probably won't do huge investments in footprints.
Three racks.
Yeah.
the Oracle method, garages. Yeah. I think Oracle is technically there as well in a region, but again, I don't count them. But, you know, it's sort of, you know, I can think about this from a sustainability perspective. I'm like, yeah, so you want to put a data center in the least sustainable place in the world that requires lots of air conditioning? This is really great for our green energy goals. So maybe AWS will stay away from it for that for a while first. Like they'll get green everywhere else, and then go get to the expensive places.
Yeah. Google was the first, though, that they're the big sustainability play, you know.
But is there only, I think they only have one other region where AWS already had Bahrain and UAE. Like, do you want to add a third in a really bad air conditioning market? I don't know.
Fair enough.
Do you think this data sovereignty kick, I'm going to call it a kick, just to, you know.
It's a fad.
Yeah. Do you think it'll eventually kind of go away? Because honestly, if everyone has their own rules, I get that. Everyone has those desires. But Google and Azure, AWS, they're not going to build a data center in every country in the world, everywhere. And so at some point, something's going to have to give. So will the data sovereignty kind of like be less of an issue with stronger encryption and better, you know, other controls than physical location?
Countries who don't have a viable business model for attracting the clouds are going to have to change their model because they're not going to have an option for data sovereignty.
Well, I mean, like Saudi Arabia as a market is not a huge market other than, you know, Aramco and the other Saudi owned businesses. So it's a market. It's not a huge market, but to build a whole data center region there is not, I can't really make sense of it from a financial perspective versus other countries.
Yeah. I would not be surprised if the Saudi government has a deal where they're helping subsidize it because they want that functionality in their country.
And that's a very possible option as well, but
that's what I do.
I think that a lot of this data sovereignty challenge is that we, you know, Safe Harbor fell many years ago now, and there really was never been a replacement for Safe Harbor that has stood up to legal scrutiny. And so I think that kind of opened the door to this data sovereignty issue. And then, you know, economic opportunity of cloud becomes a big issue for these countries. We see every time we get one of these announcements, you know, they talk about the big investment they're going to make in the region and all the jobs they're going to create and all the training they're going to provide to the local economy and how they're going to spur new businesses to support the cloud movement. It's made it so it's very attractive for a smaller country to want to be a cloud region because it brings that investment. And so I think there's the data sovereignty is one way to get those people to now consider bringing their cloud to your region because you have rules that you have to meet and require to do it. So it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. But I think I do sort of feel like it has to hit an end point at some point because the other side of it is the businesses that have to support, you know, their products in multiple regions, the complexity and the CI/CD requirement for that, and that it's all very expensive over time. And if you had to support, you know, 20 regions for your product and each region only supports 5 or 10 customers, is it really economically viable for you to do that? I don't think it is. And I think that's going to be the bigger risk to data sovereignty is going to be the vendors who have to support it aren't going to be able to do it. They can't afford to, especially in the economic headwinds we're in right now.
I just hope the people that know that that's going to be difficult to support and not profitable are the ones that are the same ones that are responsible for targeting those additional markets. Because, you know, I think that's, you see a lot of businesses where there's that disconnect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then the company folds, right? Because it doesn't make any money. And so hopefully in the ones that, you know, have a good setup, we'll succeed in that.
Have you been waiting months and months to hire a new AWS, GCP, or Azure architect only to have them be poached at the 11th hour by a startup with a juice bar? Initiative stalled because you're having trouble hiring? Well, I have a simple solution, Foghorn Consulting. Foghorn Consulting provides top-notch cloud engineers to the world's most innovative companies and can be burning down your DevOps and cloud backlogs as soon as next week. Foghorn's certified AWS, GCP, and Azure professionals are armed with infrastructure as code and from day one will be designing performant, optimized cloud-native or hybrid environments that deliver on the promise of cloud. Their FogOps solution even provides on-demand cloud engineering to augment your existing teams. Visit www.foghornconsulting.com or send an email to cloudtalentnow@foghornconsulting.com and tell them the CloudPod sent you. Your dedicated FogOps team is with you for the long haul, and they bring their own juice.
Well, the next thing from Azure, they like to announce a lot this week, considering they've been pretty much quiet for the last month. I appreciate the many stories, but we have a couple more Azure ones to go today. So first up, Azure Load Testing is now generally available, which provides you a fully managed load testing service that allows you to generate high-scale load, gain actionable insights, and ensure resiliency of your apps and service, regardless of where they're hosted. Pay only for what you need with a configurable number of load engine instances and networking paths. And if your app is based in Azure, it would also allow you to identify performance bottlenecks across your Azure application components, and you can automate regression testing by running load tests as part of your CI/CD workflows on the Azure cloud. Load testing resources are $10 per month and include 50 virtual user hours per month. An additional virtual user hour will cost you 15 cents per additional VUH up to 9,950, and basically a quarter of a penny. So what is that? Seven? I don't know. Can't do math. After that. So it goes down in price. That's all you need to know. It goes down. It goes half of that. It's half of 15 cents, basically. So there you go.
I think this is a perfect example of a service I want to be managed by the cloud. Like this, you know, having built similar type mechanisms or just manually setting up like JUnit to sort of do stuff, like this is something that I don't want to do if I have to do it, right? I want the results of, you know, knowing that my application is going to survive under load, but do I really want to maintain all this infrastructure? And, you know, when you get to like web scale, like how do you generate enough traffic to simulate, you know, your traffic? And that this is nightmarish, especially if you're smaller, but you want to be able to scale, or at least be have a certainty that you can scale to a certain point. So I love services like this. I think that this is definitely worth it. You know, the pricing is pretty good, I think, for the amount of requests that you can generate with this. And it's especially if you don't plan on doing this like every, you know, 15 minutes, like this is pretty reasonable. I like it.
Yeah, tailor-made for the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. This is one of the earliest use cases for why I wanted to go to cloud was load testing and load testing generation. So I think Amazon's had a service for a while. So I'm surprised this didn't exist already, but you know, hey, better late than never.
Tying them to GitHub Actions, cancel release, run load test. Be awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Goodbye, next up, performance team.
next never up that is...
easy. Yeah, well, they're the ones who have to, you know, cobble it all together, right? Like, it just changes, just like everything else.
Mm-hmm. They get Sherlocked on their code, too, so that way they don't have to write as much of it. It's great for them. All right, our final announcement is a partnership announcement between Azure and F5 with the announcement of the general availability of Nginx as a service, or Nginx AAS. This comes from the partnership with F5, as I mentioned, based on inputs from customers in the open source world and users of Nginx offerings. They work with F5 to simplify the infrastructure management, provide a seamless experience by integrating the deployment, billing, and support of the Nginx solution on the Azure Cloud Platform, all available to you via the Azure Marketplace. Services integrated natively into the Azure control plane, and pricing is based on the Nginx capacity unit, which no one knows what that means. So you have to link to three articles to find it. Basically, the NCU is equivalent of 20 Azure compute units, and an NCU provides 60 megabits per second of networking throughput and 400 concurrent connections. And the pricing tiers go from 30 cents to 50 cents per 10 NCU. And those tiers are not based on volume, they're based on region. So if you go to Australia, it's 50 cents. If you're in the US, it's 30 cents. So don't think it's like tiering based on volume. It is tiering purely based on location. a little weird wrinkle to their pricing model. So you basically, for the low price of 30 cents per hour, you get 600 megabits of networking throughput and 4,000 concurrent connections, which is not a terrible starting place for many apps.
If you're not sure what it'll cost, just turn it on and watch. You'll know immediately, faster than, and cheaper than it would cost to try to calculate it.
Yeah. And if you know Nginx isn't that hard, but if you have it on prem and you need a better way to manage it, and you don't want to manage Nginx, it's a nice migration method too. So
always a plus. Point your Azure load tester at it, and you'll see how much it costs.
There you go.
Use those tools. All right, well, let's move on to our Cloud Journey series. This week, we talk about accounts versus projects. And I think we first of all have to start about talking about what is an account and what is a project.
Depends which cloud provider you're on, right?
Yes. So accounts
AWS.
Is AWS. And then projects, people were like, GCP. We don't really want that. We really want projects, which is GCP and Azure constructs. So, but basically, they're collections of services and APIs and methodologies that you can subdivide into these account or project domains that you can then use for security or access patterns. And billback is also a pretty important use of it as well. And so the very first question when you get to a data center team and they say, we're moving to the cloud, they go, why do I need more than one? And so maybe that's a good starting place as well to, why would you not want one account, Ryan?
Oh, let me tell you. I mean, there's a lot of concerns, right? The way we manage workloads in data centers, it makes a lot of sense initially to try to replicate that in the cloud. And so you get your cloud account, you create your network just like you would in your data center, and you start deploying VMs in it. But you quickly realize that once that is all available at the click of a button in a console or an API, and you want to start introducing things that change dynamically based on other things, that you will run into all kinds of nightmares and headaches if you try to do that within a single ecosystem. You know, there's quotas for use of cloud resources. There's blast radius concerns because changes are much more frequent. And there's a lot of, you know, blast radius and isolation that you would get or you wouldn't get in the data center either, but you restrict it to your ops personnel. And then you sort of get it where you can, if you allow access into your cloud resources and democratize a lot of that access and working patterns, then you can all of a sudden take advantage of a lot more things. But doing that in one big bucket is a huge risk that I don't recommend anyone take.
Yeah, and I think if we go back in time, sort of the first mover disadvantage, Amazon had to think up the way it was going to work and then try it out. And I think they did a ton of things right. But I think the one thing they did wrong was they kind of bet in the beginning that you're going to be able to get API blast radius partitioning using fine-grained IAM permissions. Mm-hmm. And it was, to me, that was the huge fail vote. Trying to do it with customers who had one account, it was literally impossible. Like, not all of the features were fully implemented to let you do it. You had to start changing your architecture based on which API calls supported conditionals and which didn't, things like that. It was nuts. But with that assumption that everyone's going to have one account, they got themselves into a position where now they have to figure out a way to give this holistic customer experience with multiple accounts.
Yeah, which is why we slowly saw, you know, organizations and a control tower and these capabilities that kind of got bolted on later to try to deal with account sprawl, where in the project ecosystem of Google, you still had your master account, but then inside of that, you had all these projects, and same thing with Azure. And in the case of Azure, you actually tied those to billing contracts and to billing agreements around these things. This is an area that Azure recognized very early on that multi-account was going to be a thing and that projects were a better construct of multi-account. And then Google looked at both of them and said, yeah, we're just going to copy the Azure one because it's better. Now, the one difference is, one thing they didn't copy at Google that Azure can do is you can actually move resources between projects in Azure without destroying them, where unfortunately in GCP, you still have to destroy and redeploy to move between a project. Which is like, why didn't you copy that one thing? That was one of the pluses of the Azure project model. And that is one of the detractors of both the AWS accounts and the GCP accounts, is that if you mess this up, you then now have things stuck inside of that account until you destroy them and deploy them into different accounts. I believe there are certain magic ways you can get support to move some of these things for you, but it's very painful and not something they're going to say yes to you unless you basically threaten to walk away and pound, jump up and down really loud.
And you're spending $1 million a month or more.
And you, yeah exactly.
I think the thing about running any service, any reliable service, is that you do need to be very aware of your customers and protect yourself, protect the service from your customers. That means isolating them in a way that one customer cannot affect another customer. So as far as Amazon's concerned, the account for them is where they control and in fact, Google as well. But the account for them is where they control rate limits and quotas for all of their managed services as well. And so I think that's why that construct exists. And then in the same thinking, you would also want to deploy multiple accounts to run your own services in, so that your own services can be protected from each other's bad actions or mistakes. You don't want one service going crazy on an API and all of a sudden another microservice that needs DynamoDB or something can no longer operate. And so it's a very good way of segregating services from each other.
And one of the challenges, I think, in your data center team coming in and doing this work is that if they're looking at a very instance-heavy model, static instances will work just fine. I want a big account. But as soon as you start wanting to do auto-scaling, or you want to start moving into Kubernetes or into managed services, this becomes, the quotas on the APIs become a big issue real quickly. And yeah, the worst thing ever is my non-production thing, it just used up all the API calls, and now the production service can't write to S3, which is a terrible use case. And that can happen to you if you don't have that if you don't have the boundary and those issues.
And you find out when it's too late to make a quick change, and then it's painful.
Yeah. And then you find out that the automated quota system is not so automated at Amazon, and not all quotas are actually liftable. And then you get into really cranky conversations with your support team. Like, why? What do you mean you can't just increase my quota from 5 to 10,000? Like, yeah, those are fun conversations. I've been in those many times.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is a real challenge, and it's something to take very seriously, because there are quotas on so many levels and so many different areas that it's really hard to think through. Like, your quota for how you manage number of instances or space on a network storage device versus number of API calls of a managed service, or they reside in, at least in my head, in different parts of the brain, right? It's very tricky to sort of organize that into a cohesive management layer. And that's really, getting back to the series, is that that's why you have a center of excellence. They're positioned centrally to be able to orchestrate all the different moving parts and be able to facilitate the communication between all the different projects and parts of not only your business, but also your cloud provider's business as well.
So there's, we talked about some of the evolutions that we've seen in projects and accounts, with organizations and control towers. But I would say that there have been some things that were not necessarily well thought out that you should be aware of. Things like shared VPC, which is a concept that you can create a VPC in one AWS account, and then you can share it to other VPC, to other AWS accounts, is that they can then put resources and assets inside of the VPC. On paper, it made a lot of sense. You're like, oh, this is great. I can have like my AD or this bigger network that I'm gonna share with more accounts, but I get all the API protection and I get these things. But then the reality, there was really sharp edges that hurt really bad, and I don't recommend them for lots of things. So, this is an area that there's been a lot of experimentation by the cloud providers to kind of figure out how to make this work. Some of them have been good organizations. Bravo, fantastic. Being able to do CSPs for control security plane at the organization level is great. Shared VPC, not so great.
It would have been great if it worked.
Yeah, there's just too many edge cases it didn't support. And then it was very inflexible. And I do think that goes back to the fact that they're building on this multi-account scaffolding around their sort of legacy single account, infrastructure or design rather. Because it's very clear, like, you share a subnet or a VPC in Amazon and then unshare it, it doesn't go away from that member account.
It's no different than security groups. Yeah. You can't leave the security group because something still has it attached, like an ENI still has it attached. So it does make resource management difficult, especially if one group's responsible for creating the group and another team is responsible for consuming it and attaching it to their resources. But the shared VPC thing is a nice idea. And in fact, Google ran with it completely, and it's their best practice that you create one regional or global VPC and then share it from a host project to multiple other projects.
Yeah. But it does, it does really require a different mechanism, and it means that you are completely dependent on a core networking team to manage that that infrastructure, and you're beholden to their timelines and their priorities, and you know, you're going to be bound by their processes. And so if you want more IPs, you're going to have to coordinate with that team. It's very anti-cloud. And so it's, I think it, you know, like there's no easy answer here because connecting multiple things has to be sort of considered and done carefully. But it, I do think that it's on, you know, cloud users and application architects and developers to really think about the things that they need to communicate intra-system and things that they can just sort of have in complete isolation and no different than any other publicly accessible resource, because it does change how you build it.
Yeah, I still think we're very early on in cloud adoption. There are still countless data centers. There's still countless workloads on-prem. I don't know very many sort of native, you know, cloud native workloads. Things are very hybrid still. I expect that once many more people have moved away from the hybrid nature, and we don't need a direct connect, and we don't need, I mean, a direct connect has two ends, your data center at one end, and it has to terminate somewhere at the other end. It has to terminate in one account, and that's going to be the account that the VPC shared from. Perhaps when, you know, we don't have the direct connects and we don't have those concerns about connecting back to on-prem, it won't be quite so much of an issue. We won't be quite so tied to the old architecture. And well, things will be a bit more distributed.
I mean, I think it's just going to move to where it's you're directly connecting to cloud providers, right? Like that's...
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking about like all the things we've done in Service Mesh, the Transit Gateway on AWS. You know, these constructs now connect multiple different VPCs and multiple different things together, sort of continue that issue. And the reality is we're not going to single cloud for most companies. We're going to hybrid. We're going to multi-cloud. And so that becomes the reality is that you're always going to have some of these constructs that have to cross BGP. And as soon as you hit a BGP wall where you're crossing an internet routing layer, you're going to have to go back to the legacy model until you reinvent BGP, which many have tried and many have failed. Yeah. I mean, I still remember Internet 2 was going to be the future, and I still don't have Internet 2. So.
Well, this kind of veering out to the CCOE stuff, but I really think that because that's very true, multi-cloud's very true, I think software-defined networking is going to become even more important in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a really simple topic, but it's a very important topic. So I don't have a lot more to say about it. Maybe you guys do, but you know, this is one of those areas that I really, you know, it's just as important as the other things we talked about with security and VPCs and things. And like, this is the one that will bite you when you're least expecting it. Mm-hmm. Because you'll always run into that edge case. That's going to be like, oh no, what do we do now? And normally the answer is destroy everything and start over.
Yeah. I always try to protect customers from trying to put together their 10-year architecture, like, you know, future proof your cloud architecture for the next 10 years. It's like, it's not going to happen. And it's super cheap to rip and replace stuff. And your needs are going to change. The cloud's going to change. Just build for the next 18 months or whatever it is that you know about. And we'll have enough leave. We'll have enough ramp to know when we have to be modifying. But this is the one exception. This is the piece you could just paint yourself into a corner and have pain for forever. We have customers who have years upon years upon years of pain still, because of decisions they made, which were good decisions at the time, you know, mm-hmm. before they had organizations and these other tools. Yeah. So
I think it's important to not try to answer the next 10 years of problems, but also to try to build in like circuit breakers or flexibility into your design so that you can quickly adapt. And I think that's, you know, account structure is a really good way to do that, because you can define that blast radius or that thing that you're going to have to replace is granular as, you know, possible.
Yeah, just and assume. So think, yeah. Prod's yeah. not in one account. So
nope.
Anything yeah. you're going to write to manage it, you have to first figure out which account it's in and then go do the thing in the account mm-hmm. and not assume it's in the one account. And then all of a sudden it gets easy, right? You're just like, oh, we hit something we didn't plan on. That's okay. Just spin up another prod account, scale into the next one until we get a little more optimized.
Yeah, just assume that whatever you think is a singular value is not a singular value. Whether exactly. it's an environment, whether it's a region, whether it's a name, you know, don't assume that there's only going to be one ever. Yeah.
I remember, you know, Ryan and I's last big AWS project, and we thought we were so clever because we were like, we're going to create this network design, and we're going to create an extra subnet in every account. Mm-hmm. And that extra subnet will, you know, be our scaling, you know, emergency valve with, like, we really desperately need it. And it was great. And we were super excited about it. And then we found Lambda. Mm-hmm. And Lambda screwed everything, because at that time, Lambda in the VPC had to use up IP addresses inside of my VPC network. And then we just ran, like, those you know, slash Cs or slash 24s, they got maxed out real quick.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you realize, well, yeah, one size fits all VPC design is not going to work. And then we pivoted to T-shirt size VPCs. Like, what do you think you're going to do? And what are the managed services you're going to use? Like,
yeah.
But, you know, that original thing worked really well for the first year. And then year two hit, and we said, Lambda's the future. We love Lambda. It's amazing. And we became, you know, one of the largest Lambda consumers on the West Coast for AWS. And we learned all the scaling problems of Lambda. So, you know, I feel like I'm a pretty good expert. I feel Ryan feels he's a pretty good expert. We still make these mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
But, You gotta be able to pivot, and, you know, if you can do a little bit of future thinking to say, like, well, there might be a day sometime where I do need something, you can be a little bit of cautious about a couple of things, but it's hard to predict the future. And you see our prediction shows, we're terrible at it.
Yeah.
It's really hard, man.
Well, some of us didn't win after 2 weeks.
Anybody can predict the future, everyone would be rich.
We should ask ChatGPT or Bard how they would design a VPC.
Yeah, really.
Can you generate
one big subnet? Yeah. MAC addresses. I could just use MAC addresses.
Yeah.
All right. Well, next week, we're kind of getting to the home stretch of our CCOE journey here. And we're going to talk about automating the CCOE and metrics around it. And then I'm going to give us a bonus topic around migration. I've been pinging people on Twitter and saying, hey, share with me your migration stories and what you learned and all that, so we can kind of share that with you guys as well. So find me on Twitter or on Mastodon. You can find us there, and you can see my tweet thread where I've asked for feedback and, like, what were the migration lessons learned you had, and we'll share that as kind of a wrap-up to our whole CCOE story. But next week, we'll talk about those last two pieces around automation and metrics, and how do you measure success of your CCOE over the next several months of your journey and years of your journey. So look forward to that. That's it for another fantastic week in the cloud. Have a good night, Peter, Ryan, and Jonathan.
See you later.
Good night.
Bye, everybody.
And that is the week in cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Foghorn Consulting. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and tweet us your feedback at #TheCloudPod. Or join our Slack channel, go to our website, thecloudpod.net, for sign-up instructions.